The Living of These Days for March 23rd, 1980. We bring you now The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth. Now here's the minister, Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr.
Good morning. I find that there are a lot of people in the world who don't like their names. For example, I don't like the name Royal very much. When I was a child, I thought it sounded distinguished, but the older I get, the less I care to be saddled with a name like that. But there is one name, I think, that nobody would want to have, and that is the name Judas. It was a good name until Judas Iscariot came along. Indeed, one of Jesus' other disciples was named Judas. But ever since Judas Iscariot, this name has probably become the most repugnant in human history. Yet in the Bible, we read that after a night of prayer, Jesus appointed Judas Iscariot to be one of his closest disciples. I wonder, and perhaps you have wondered too, how Jesus could have done a thing like that. There is a traditional answer to that question, of course, but I don't find much sense in it. After we have heard from our choir, I'm going to reflect on how Jesus came to appoint that man named Judas to be one of the 12.
Jesus,
once again, we welcome you to The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of Pilgrim Congregational Church. I'm Dr. Royal Shepherd, minister of the church, and today I plan to speak about another of the prayers of Jesus. This particular prayer is described in the 6th chapter of Luke. In these days, he went out into the mountain to pray. And all night he continued in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Now this scene comes to us easily. We have seen it pictured. Jesus kneeling on the mountainside as the sky darkens. Even if we had not seen it pictured, the scene would come readily to our imaginations, for it is natural, it is appropriate. It fits in with our image of Jesus, someone whose name I have lost wrote long ago, the greatest spiritual fact that has ever emerged in the long story of the race is Jesus of Nazareth's unbroken consciousness of God. Now here we find that consciousness renewed and intensified. And here too, we find Jesus pursuing that policy that is so characteristic of him. Before each momentous decision, he turns to prayer. Now it is evident what Jesus is deciding during this long night's watch. Perhaps there are other matters on his mind, but the one central concern is the selection of those 12 men who will become his chief representatives. No doubt some of these 12 already are part of the inner circle of Jesus' movement. But now it seems he wants to make it official that these men will be both his closest confidants and the leaders of his movement in time to come. He seems to believe, too, that there is a certain symbolic value in choosing 12 as representing the 12 tribes of ancient Israel. Now, when we note that there were 12 men, the thought may leap to our minds these days that there were no women. Now, if we think that contemporary culture is sexist, we ought to consider how things were in ancient cultures. There was no way that Jesus could have put women into such positions as these and kept any credibility at all. Already, some people thought he was something of a crazy man. To have, let us say, 6 women among the 12, speaking in the synagogues, walking from town to town, proclaiming the message, representing symbolically the authority of the 12 tribes, quite literally eating and sleeping with Jesus and the other men, day by day, night by night, this was an option quite beyond the wildest fantasy of any Galilean, I am sure, whether he was male or whether she was female. Still, it is important for us to note that there were women disciples. For the 12, after all, were not the only people called disciples. They were not the only people who followed Jesus. Some of the others, indeed, may have proved more influential and useful in the long run than did those 12. And among those others, it is notable that there were women and that they received quite a bit of attention in the Gospels. As the old saying goes, it was women who were last at the cross and first at the tomb. But now Jesus makes the hard choice of choosing 12 key men. All night he seeks divine guidance in this matter. And in the dawn he goes down the hillside a ways to where a large group of his disciples are camped for the night. He summons 12 of them to be apostles, which is to say emissaries, people sent out to represent himself and his movement. Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And Judas Iscariot. I wonder if you have wondered how Jesus could make a choice like that. How could he do it, especially after devoting a whole night in prayerful reflection? Well, of course, we may say that this was part of God's plan. Someone had to be the instrument of Jesus' redeeming sacrifice, and God decided from the foundations of the world that that person should be Judas. But I have trouble with that way of thinking. Perhaps God did foresee what Judas would do and in his providence acted to turn Judas' action to his saving purpose. But I find it hard to accept the idea that God doomed this one man from all eternity to be a traitor. If in that case, Judas was but a cipher, but an automaton, unworthy either of our blame or of our compassion. I think that like all men, Judas made his choice, and that he was responsible for that. Now Jesus also made his choice of Judas, and he was responsible for that. I also find it hard to believe that Jesus foresaw everything that would happen to him in fixed and perfect detail. Had he done that, had he had that power, he would not have possessed a human mind. Indeed, he would not have been a human being. And one of the most important things that the Bible and the ancient creeds have to say to us is that Jesus was indeed a human being. But if he did foresee the events surrounding his own death, I find it even harder to believe that he would have chosen Judas to be his disciple with those events in view. In itself, the crucifixion of Jesus was a monstrous evil. Jesus accepted the risk of his execution as an outcome of his own fidelity. But he did not choose crucifixion as something to be desired in itself. To have done that would have been quite wrong, quite sick indeed. A soldier may go into battle knowing that there is a strong possibility, perhaps even a probability, that he will lose his life for the sake of his cause or his country. But that's something quite different from going into battle just so that one may be killed. Jesus did not choose the evil of his own torture and death. Rather, he risked these possibilities in the service of love and of life. So then, I cannot believe that Jesus chose Judas just so that he would have somebody around who was certain to betray him. I think he chose Judas because he believed that Judas was a man with a good deal to offer. Well, then how could he have been so wrong? How could he have been so mistaken in his appraisal of this man? It is possible, of course, that he did not have much material to work with. The crowd of followers on the mountainside may have been a rather unpromising bunch of people. As matters turned out, others among the 12 showed serious defects of character. Peter was impetuous, boastful, melodramatic, cowardly, and according to Paul, even years later, somewhat hypocritical. John and James were inclined to violence and vindictiveness. Thomas was skeptical. These men never were plastic saints. Well, might we ask, why did Jesus choose such men as these? A few weeks ago, in another sermon, I noted that the people who gathered about Jesus were not the wise or the educated or the genteel or the wealthy. Perhaps they were not even especially noteworthy for their virtue. Still, Judas' crime puts him, I think, in a different category. Selling out the master for a few pieces of silver, selling out the Lord of Lords. The other disciples had their faults. All men do. And it might be said that the material Jesus had to work with is, or has to work with, is never very promising. But not all men are traitors in this way. Certainly that is true. And yet I think there must have been some good in Judas. There must have been some potential in him that prompted Jesus to pick him out from among the crowd that morning. There are, I think, some men who are built on a larger scale than others. Their potential for both good and evil is very great. Their gifts are towering gifts, but their sins are abysmal sins. Perhaps King David was such a man. He was a man of extraordinary versatility, a military strategist, nation builder, musician, poet. He was a man of profound religious faith, of warm affection, of passionate devotion to other people. He was a man of quick and fervent sense of what was right and just. Yet David was also capable of scheming the shabbiest crimes. He was one of those large-scale men. Perhaps Instead of Judas, Jesus might have chosen a man of a smaller scale, a safer sort of man. But when one is engaged in a great adventure, one does not seek safe men. One seeks men who have the potential to leave their mark on history, whether for good or for evil. Perhaps then Jesus was a man whose good points and whose bad points were both writ large. Of course, we don't know that because we have no record of his talents and virtues. But that's not to say that he possessed none. My guess is that Judas is the most extreme case or example of the truth of Mark Antony's assertion in Shakespeare's Caesar. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred in their bones or with their bones. The people who wrote the New Testament were amazing for their candor. Though Peter went on to become the chief pillar of the church, these writers set down without reservation Jesus' sharp admonitions to his first disciples. But if the gospel writers could tell of Peter's weaknesses, it was beyond even them, I imagine, to tell of Judas's virtues. His one act of betrayal obliterated from memory everything else about him. Forever after, in the church at least, Judas became not the non-person, as we say today, but rather the anti-person, the one person in history who was 100% negative. And yet the fact remains. After that night of prayer, Jesus chose Judas. It makes us think. Now, my thoughts this morning have been largely speculative. We don't know what Judas' good points may have been or whether he had any good points at all that were worth noting. I can only say that I find it more believable that Jesus chose Judas to be one of the 12 because he saw something good in him than because he saw something evil. In those days, he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. Some of us in our church have been talking about prayer. How can we ever be sure that the guidance we think we find in prayer is right? Sometimes our prayerful decisions lead to unhappy results. For example, in regard to a marriage partner, people make a choice regarding another person. It may even be a prayerful choice. They gather in church with their friends. Everybody has come to a prayerful conclusion that these two people are just right for each other. The minister, speaking for the others, asks God to bless this union. So far, as anyone can tell, God doesn't object. And then, 6 months later, the people who chose each other so prayerfully go their separate ways. Or it may be 5 years later, or 10, or as seems increasingly common these days, 40 years later. And who knows whether even if they do not go their separate ways, the union is blessed. One wonders increasingly right now whether there is much correlation between people staying together and the overall quality of marriages. Perhaps on the average, the people who get divorced are about as happy in their marriages as the people who do not. In any case, one wonders too about these prayerful choices. Was the choice wrong because 35 years later the marriage runs out? A year or so ago, a friend of mine, who must have been married for about that long, wrote to say he was getting divorced. I wrote back to say that I thought we had to question the common assumption that because at any point in time a marriage ends that way, it must have been a total loss from the very start. Now, that's an easy assumption, and I think it's one that a lot of us like to make because it's simple. Just as we like to make the assumption that Judas must have been evil from the skin to the core all the days of his life. But the practical truth may well be that such a marriage may have been as good or better than most marriages for the greater share of those 35 years. And so it may well have been that the practical truth was that Judas' discipleship was as good or better than that of the other 12, or the other 11, for most of the time between his appointment and his act of betrayal. Well, I admit that's a rather radical thought, but think about it. So then, let us not conclude too quickly that Jesus made a wrong choice, or that for some strange and absurd reason, he made a choice that he knew would lead to disaster. Of course, disillusionment is likely to set in when our prayerful decisions do seem to lead to undesirable results. I knew a couple once who decided to buy a motel in a community quite a distance away from where they had lived all their lives. I called on them shortly before they moved, and I could tell that they were very anxious about this whole enterprise. Now, while the motel prospect looked good, and I didn't hear anything about it that sounded very bad to me, I could sense that there was a lot of self-doubt in these two people. The man had always worked for other people. He'd never done anything really on his own. Sensing their anxiety, I offered a prayer for their new undertaking. A year later, the couple returned. The motel proved to be a dismal failure. The person from whom they bought it had misrepresented the amount of the business. She hadn't told them that the motel had lost its AAA rating just before they bought it. The couple from my church managed to get something back from the previous owner, but the net result of their investment and their labor was a loss. And what was worse, I suspect, was that their dream had fallen to pieces and that their confidence was shattered. And they returned very demoralized. Now, they didn't come to church as much after that. I couldn't be sure, but I suspected that they might have held me and perhaps God as well partly accountable. After all, I had sought God's blessing on the enterprise, and it turned out to be a mistake. One wonders whether Jesus was not tempted to feel this way about divine guidance too, and about some of the things that he felt God had guided him to do. There's a theory that Judas betrayed Jesus because he was disillusioned. You see, Jesus didn't turn out the way he had hoped. He had expected that Jesus would lead some kind of political revolution, and that didn't happen. And so out of his bitterness and his disappointment, his disillusionment, he turned Jesus in. But if Judas was disillusioned in Jesus, how much more reason had Jesus to be disillusioned in Judas? More than that, how much reason to be disillusioned in people generally, even disillusioned in God, who allowed him to make that fatal appointment one morning on the mountainside? At the very end, Jesus quoted the bleak complaint that leads off the 22nd Psalm. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Perhaps Jesus was thinking then of how that on that night on the mountain, when he prayed so hard and he prayed so long, he decided on Peter and Andrew and James and John and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James the son of Alphaeus and Simon called the Zealot and the other Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Well, these reflections have taken us over much territory with some twists and turnings. What can we say to sum it up? The prayerful decision is no sure thing. It is always a risk. Even when the prayerful decision is the best decision, it offers no guarantee that the path we have chosen will lead us from beginning to end down one great shining white way. The path we choose prayerfully today may in time lead into the valley of the shadow, and then, as at all times, more prayerful decisions will be required of us. The decision on the mountain may lead to the decision in Gethsemane. So it was with Jesus, so it is with us. But that's not to say that the prayerful decision is in vain. So long as people go up the mountain to discern God's plan, God can and will work with them for good. The decision of Gethsemane leads to Easter. And on that day, the 11 who prove loyal will gather to share the news. Let's join together now for a closing moment of prayer. O God, day by day we look to you to guide us in the best way. We take risks of choosing and deciding, knowing that these choices and decisions may lead to fatal results. Sometimes we find that those we trusted betray us, and we find that those whose confidence we need mistrust us. It is hard to keep faith under these conditions. Make us brave, then, always to seek your way and to venture into the dark valley with the confidence that you will keep faith with us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Crown thine ancient church's story, bring her but to glorious flower. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the facing of this hour.
You have been listening to The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church, with Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr., Minister. For copies of today's sermon or comments on this program, please contact the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth. 877-285-5812. And please join us next week at this same time for The Living of These Days.